Okay, we are back in Ecclesiastes. We're in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Do a little bit of recap from the past 2 weeks. You remember 2 weeks ago that our inability to understand God's sovereignty as he determines the times and the seasons of human life, that should lead us to fall on our knees in humble worship and fear of God and awe and joyfully receive what he gives us, joyfully receive his sovereign determined times. And then last week, we looked a little bit at some more of the hevel we find under the sun, right? Corruption and oppression and envy. And I wanted to make one more side note that I wasn't really able to make last week. What Solomon's not encouraging us to do is to turn a blind eye to those things, to oppression, and just say, well, it's hevel. That's just life under the sun. There's nothing I can do about it, so I'll let it go. No, that's not really the topic he's addressing. He would say, no, absolutely be active in justice and seek it, pursue it. But understand that that's going to be a part of this broken world that we live in. And so he sees that and he's frustrated by it, and he sees that the envy and corruption are driving work and all of our energies and efforts are driven by competition. And he says, wouldn't it be so much better if we flip back to the beginning of chapter 4? He says, then I saw all toil and all skill and work came from a man's envy of his neighbor. That's vanity and a striving after the wind. So what do we do? Do we just fold our hands and essentially self-destruct and laziness? No. He says, or do we get both of our hands full and chase after the wind? No. It's better to have a handful with quietness than any of those things. To be content, to be satisfied with a day's work, to be satisfied with the piece of the pie that God has given to you and rejoice in that. So now we're to the second to last section. You know, Ecclesiastes, just give a little bit more review because we've got a lot of people just jumping right into the middle of this morning. So we've got Ecclesiastes is broken up into two sections, two halves, essentially 1 through 6 and then 7 through 12. And who, maybe for the sake of review, I'll keep asking every week, who can tell me what word and phrase Kohelet or Solomon uses to divide up the sections in the first 6 chapters? Vanity and striving after the wind, or shepherding the wind. That's his phrase that he uses to divide up the first 6 chapters. So every time we see that, we say, okay, here's another major break. And one of the reasons for that is that he never uses vanity and striving after the wind at all in the second half of the book. It's as solely used in the first half. Okay, so we're to our next section, which is chapter 4, verses 7 through the, in our English Bibles, it's through the end of the chapter. There's chapter 5, verse 1 for us is actually chapter 4, verse 17 in the Hebrew Bible, as it were. But for us, it's broken up through the end of chapter 4. And then we have one more section until we're halfway through the book. That section is lengthy. It's all of chapter 5 and most of chapter 6. So it may take us 2 to 3 weeks to get through that. So let's read together Ecclesiastes 4, 7 through the end of chapter 4. It says again in verse 7, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother. Yet there is no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with the youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after the wind. And if, as we were looking through, you see on the screen a lot of various underlines and circled things. Those are all things that we've already previously identified as themes throughout the book. So those are, I kind of identified those already beforehand so we can just visually recognize them as we go through. This is Solomon's great adventure, his experiment of life under the sun. That is his sphere of observation. And so he's been going through and saying, a lot of it looks like vanity. In his great experiment, he's saying, okay, I see hevel is the Hebrew word, hevel everywhere. Hevel meaning frustration, hevel meaning enigmas, mysteries, despair, meaning the idea is smoke. So you just get kind of like, it's temporary, it's temporal, but it's also confusing and enigmatic. And so here he identifies another topic that we'll look at today. So as you've seen, and this has been something as I started that I didn't really recognize as a major way that Solomon communicates, but every week throughout the past few weeks, he's always saying, I saw, right? And that sort of marks, I saw vanity under the sun, or I saw something under the sun, and it was this. So here today, we're going to be talking about the hevel of isolation. We have one person who has no other. We're talking about today, there is one, but no second. Isolation, solitude, someone who shuts others out, living as a relational hermit, right? Some like the deserted island idea. Some of you may be thinking, that doesn't sound so bad, right? Deserted island paradise, you mean. And today we're kind of going to critique that idea. Solomon's going to critique that idea and notice the vanity of it, the frustration of it, and examine the benefits of what I'm going to call companionship theology, right? Like the idea of how we're intended to operate in relationship with one another. So I guess just to pose the question at the beginning, how do you think about relationships with other people? Depending on our personalities, obviously, we naturally tend toward something or another. Some of us love the idea of people and relationships. And I think for you today, perhaps consider, are those genuine? Are those deep? What is the depth of those relationships? Are they just a mile wide and an inch deep type of idea? Do they actually produce benefit as God intends? And then perhaps for the person that says, yeah, not as big a fan of people. I struggle with that. To see the benefit and the beauty of community and relationship with each other, because that's really what Solomon's going to get at today. So he starts out identifying this person. Okay, so there's one that doesn't have a second one. He's all alone. And either son or brother. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. But he says, yet, even though he's alone, he's still in the situation where there is no end to all his toil. Okay, so there's two phrases, no end to all his toil, and then his eyes are never satisfied, and then he has a rhetorical question. For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? Okay, so phrase one, there's no end of all his toil, could mean two different things. It could mean that he works constantly. He's just always at his work. Or it could mean that he's very successful in his work. There's no end to the benefits of his work. And I think both play into the idea here that's being said. I probably prefer the first more than the second. He's constantly at his work. He's a workaholic, as it were. He's got And what Solomon's not saying here is he's not identifying here the problem of working too much. He may do that other places. He kind of did that last week. Two hands full of toil is full of striving after the wind rather than one hand full of toil with contentment, right? Or with quietness. But here, sounds like this guy has both of his hands full with toil and he's constantly at his work. He never stops. And you would think that that would mean that this person was full, right? His eyes were satisfied with all of these things that he's pursued. But no, second phrase, his eyes are never satisfied with riches. So everything that he's pursuing is leaving him empty. It's almost like an illustration of the very guy that we finished talking about last week. This is the man with two hands full and striving after the wind. But all of that might be worth it if he was doing it for others, right? All of that, maybe you could argue, would be worth it if he's got people for whom he is working, for whom all of this, he's depriving himself of pleasure and he's toiling and toiling. But no, his eyes are never satisfied. He's hungry, 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 and never filled. I was reading one poll, and I don't know the strength of it, so consider it more an illustration than hard facts. But they pulled a large company, and everyone within it was asked two questions. What's your annual salary? And then how much would you need to be comfortable in life, right? And from top to bottom, from the minimum wage worker to the CEO type of idea, everyone stated their income and then approximately on average 25% more for what they would be satisfied with, for what would make them comfortable, right? Always needing a little bit more. Never contented. Nobody said, I make $50,000 a year and that's plenty. That's great. I like $50,000 a year or $150,000 a year. No, like that's, I'm satisfied. I'm content. I'm satisfied to have my piece of pie. Nobody said that. Everyone says just a little bit more would be really nice. And so that's kind of this idea. And yet, even as perhaps each of you are considering yourself, but at least you're doing it for someone, maybe, right? Maybe it's for the family. Maybe it's for the kids. Maybe it's for so you can reach your goals. Says no, he has no one. There's no son. There's no brother. There's not even a goal in mind. His goal is emptiness. So this rhetorical, and I underlined this phrase here so that he never asks, simply because one, as you know, for this study, what I'm using is the ESV. If you have New King James or King James, then that would be in italics, which I think is a wonderful translation practice to italicize that which is not in the original text. This phrase is not in the original text. They're simply helping us to get to understand that this is the individual, the one person who has no other, asking, for whom am I toiling? It's probably not necessary. I think we would get there by ourselves. But he asks this rhetorical question. What's the purpose? What relationship am I toiling for? And I think that, I guess I already mentioned it, but that's part of the problem, is for whom, okay? I've got toil, I've got work, I'm depriving myself, and there's got to be a point where there should be others. But no, this guy is all alone, one person. And so ultimately what we see is he's doing all of this, he's toiling and depriving himself for himself. Hoarding, stockpiling, amassing. Why? He hasn't asked himself why. He doesn't have a goal. He's just doing it. He chases the wind rather than enjoying moderation accompanied by God's good gifts. The truth of the matter is there's things, good things in life that money doesn't buy. Now later on, Kohelet says, there's a lot of stuff that money does buy. He actually compares money to wisdom. He's like, money actually protects you like wisdom protects you. Money's really helpful. It shields you from a lot of bad things, right? But there are other things like relationship that money does not buy. So kind of the picture we're painting here, I'm thinking Ebenezer Scrooge idea, or you have, It's a Wonderful Life, like Mr. Potter and It's a Wonderful Life, right? You have kind of a miserly figure who doesn't care about other people. They're in it for themselves. And so they toil with two hands full for nothing, just to continue growing their stockpile. Now, the thing that might make this different is that he doesn't say they're intending to do that. He doesn't say, like, the net might be cast larger than just Ebenezer Scrooge. It might be more than just a miser. Like, we might have to consider that this is true of us too. Look around us and say, what are the relationships in my life? What is the purpose of my work? Why am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? But you have this picture, this working alone unendingly and successfully without satisfaction, brutally long hours, invested but unsatisfied. Nothing's enough, and so he labors in isolation. So that's the hevel, the vanity that we're talking about today. And it's not just vanity. He accompanies it with the phrase, and an unhappy business. This is not a fun, pleasant, enjoyable life. This is life alone. So, what's his conclusion? As he often does, he notes a problem, identifies it, and then he discusses, okay, so what do we do about this? He gives this sort of proverbial next few verses. He says, okay, two are better than one. Why? Because they have a good reward for their toil. Okay, so what does that mean? Is he saying, like, just maybe a week or two ago, we talked about, use Jerry Johnson as an illustration, and saying he was content with one handful and contentment because he's just working his company by himself and doesn't feel the need to add a bunch of other people to try and make it bigger, make it better. Is this saying, actually, if he had more people, if he had two people, he would make more money? Is that what it's saying? A lot of commentators kind of take that view. Or I think what he's saying is that they have a good reward for their toil is what he's about to talk about here in these next few verses. He describes the benefit, the reward, the gain for of companionship. So two are better than one. It's a wonderful phrase. It kind of reminds us, it takes us back to Genesis chapter 2, where God himself says that it's not good for man that he should be alone. And he chooses to make man a helpmeet or a companion. So likely here, he's not talking so much about the financial gain, but actually the creative intent that God had for companionship. There is a benefit to otherness in our lives. There's a benefit to community in our lives. So if this is the reward, then we have three examples of what the reward is: 10, 11, and 12. So taking them in order, he just says, for if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him. In each of these, there's going to be a positive statement and then a negative statement. If they fall, one will lift up, but woe to him. Again, two light together, they keep warm. Good thing. But how can one keep warm alone? Negative. And then he flips that in the verse 12. And though a man might prevail against him who is alone, aka you're going to lose in a fight by yourself, two will withstand him. So a negative and a positive in each of these illustrations. So the first one is if you fall, one will lift up his fellow. Very naturally, if you fall into trouble, right? The companionship brings help. Companionship brings, we could say, even encouragement. I guess one silly, perhaps, example of this was I was thinking back of even just times in my life that I've fallen, and if no one else was there, you'd be in trouble, right? And I thought back, actually, Johnny, to a time a long time ago when we were up at my house up in Randolph, and we were playing a game at dark, and it was raining. We were playing Capture the Flag out in the dark. and I slipped on the grass, and my knee ran into a cinder block, and it's injured since then, but like I couldn't move. I couldn't get up. And Johnny reached down and he picked me up and he carried me into the house, right? If I were alone, or I would not have had the benefit of companionship. I would not have had the benefit of help, of encouragement, right? One example. Second example is warmth, comfort. And if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And we've kind of got to be careful here with our Western ears. This could sound sexual, but it's really not. That's not his point. He's saying, there could be an implicit reference to marriage, I suppose, because when you're married, you would keep one another warm at night. But that's the point is simply like think of shepherds out in the desert, or think of soldiers out on the battlefield, or think of travelers as they're going through and it's cold at night. What do? You huddle together. You keep one another warm, right? Perhaps a modern example, if you're stranded out in a blizzard, it's good to have people with you. You keep one another warm, right? So the benefit of warmth or comfort. If you don't have another person with you, then you don't get the benefit. And then the third one is protection and security, right? Though a man may prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. Even just this past week when I was in LA for the Shepherd's Conference, we took the wrong shuttle to the wrong rental car place. And so then we ended up walking from that one to a different one instead of taking the shuttle all the way back to the airport, getting on the right one and coming all the way back. So we had a couple blocks to walk in LA, right? Better to have companions with you than to walk alone, right? Because if you're by yourself, you might not be able to ward off the trouble, but if you've got a group of you, two or more, it's a lot easier to. And then so you have two are better than one as a proverb starting the phrase. And then you get to the very end, and he has another sort of proverb. It says, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Which simply says, if two is better than one, then three and three is better than two. Essentially his idea, like strength in numbers, or better to have more companions, because the more companions, the more benefit, right? So he's just speaking very practically, very simply, very in a way that we all totally get and understand, is that there's benefit in having people around you. Now, I wanted to go back just briefly and make one comment about the idea of marriage or singleness in here, because it could sound very easily to a single person that you're like, oh, so he's saying like, go get a spouse, right? Like go get married because there's companionship there. And say, no, not at all. Marriage is an example of this, right? Marriage is a phenomenal, probably one of the greatest examples of companionship and help and the benefits that are tied within that. But that's not really what he's talking about. For a couple reasons. One, if you look at the word that he uses in verse 10, this word here, translated in English, fellow. Does anyone have a different translation of that? No? That's okay. New King James, what does King James do? It's fellow. Okay. New King James is companion. Okay. That's the idea. The same word. Okay. If you go back, actually, let's go back briefly to Malachi chapter 2. I want to show you a couple different places in which this is used. Last book of the Old Testament, chapter 2, Malachi 2. And look down in verse 14. But you say, why does he not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion, your fellow, and your wife by covenant. Okay, so it can be used to describe the marriage covenant, right? It can be used to describe that relationship. Flip over to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2 and verse 17. And it's used pretty consistently throughout the beginning of Daniel. You'll see why, right? Because then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, his fellows, his boys, right? And he told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Okay, so, and if you look at the three examples that he uses, none of them are explicitly marital, right? You could imply them because marriage is a companionship, so all of them apply to marriage, but they all apply outside too. And then if you go back to the beginning of the text that we just looked at, what are the examples that he gives of these companions? A son and a brother, okay? So this is not saying single people are out. In fact, single people are in, right? This is brotherhood or sisterhood, right? I just think of like college, right? Like these are your boys, these are your guys, like these are my friends, these are my companions, they're with me. Or you think about like military, right? Like these guys have each other's backs. Or you just think about like whoever your closest friends are, these are your fellows. This is what it's talking about. It's having people being open, having people close to you relationally, welcoming, being known and knowing other people because there's benefits inside of that. Okay, then we're going to move on to this last section here and then kind of paint a little bit of a zoomed out picture of, I think, what Solomon's getting at here. I'm going to start with 15. We'll read the whole thing, 13 through 17. Just read it one more time because this is kind of weird. It's a little bit unusual. It's a parable sort of that Solomon shares here. He says, "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king, who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with the youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him." Okay, we've got a lot of pronouns here. So the question is, who is he talking about where? Is the question. So we've got, let's just set the stage with this first verse here. Okay, so we have two people that he's talking about here. And what are the three points of comparison between the two? Okay. Poor wise youth. So what are the, break those three down. What are the three contrasts? Okay, so we've got the two that are circled already, right? The wise and the fool, okay? And then we have the poor and the king. So presumably poor and wealthy, right? So far, who do we think who's going to be? Like so far you would think that the youth is the fool, the poor fool, right? Because that's how they would be associating this in their culture, is that the young was not as wise as the old, right? Age is sage, right? But no, in this he identifies the young one as the poor wise one. So I didn't say that well, but essentially what I'm trying to say is the most important comparison is the one that we've already identified as a theme throughout the book. It's not just that he's a poor youth compared to an old king. The wisdom is the one that sets him apart as the excellent one. The wisdom sets apart the youth as the excellent one rather than the foolishness of the king. Now, what made the king foolish? Okay, he didn't listen. He didn't take counsel, right? So that's the setup. That's helpful. So then what we have to ask is, okay, so who's the he in verse 14? Are we talking about the youth went from prison to the throne, like sort of an echo or a t- tip of the hat to Joseph, that kind of idea of like someone who went from prison to not the throne, but to a high place of authority, though in his own kingdom he'd been born poor? Or are we talking about that this had happened to the king as well? Like he once was a poor, wise youth, right? Who has ascended to his greatness, even though he had once been poor. And then we have to ask the question in verse 15, I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with the, and the Hebrew says, the second youth. So is the second youth the same as this guy? Or is it a third character introduced in the story, right? The second youth. And then we get to 16, and he says, there was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Well, who's he? Are we talking about the old king, the youth, or the second youth? Like, what's going on here? And essentially, we don't quite know. It's really ambiguous. People take all sorts of different views on this. The most common would be that the youth rises from prison to the throne, echoing Joseph's rise, right? But even when he replaces the king and all the people follow him, they don't take pleasure in him. So that interpretation kind of echoes some of the earlier things in Ecclesiastes, right? About cyclicity, about generations coming, generations going, king after king after king, and nobody's remembered, right? The hevel in that, okay? That's fine. I have sort of a weird idea. Maybe it's not a weird idea, but let me pitch this to you. Tell me what you think. I'm suggesting that based on the context, right? We're talking about what? Isolation is sort of the big idea of this this section is isolation, the hevel of isolation. So with that in mind, what if we have the young man who's wise? Why? Because he listens. He welcomes other people. Okay? He's not, his heart is not in isolation. His decisions are not in isolation. He has people speaking into his life, right? While the old foolish king has lost his ability to hear the counsel, advice, warning, exhortation of others, he is in isolation. He wants nothing to do with the words of others. So though the old king, I think, himself, once went from prison to the throne despite his poverty. He once listened. He once welcomed counsel. And by doing so, and in so doing, he grew in the kingdom, even to the point of ruling it. And I think this, especially the possessive, his own kingdom, points more to the old king than it does to the youth. So he demonstrated his ability to heed the counsel of other people. And then all of the living and the king's successor himself, this wise youth, there's no end to all of these people that this now isolated king leads. And he has incredible authority and he has incredible power, but nobody takes pleasure in him. As soon as he's done, the youth ascends the throne, who's willing to embrace the counsel of other people, and no one remembers this mighty, powerful old king. Why? Because he lived in isolation. I think it's contextually at least a decent idea. So with that in mind then, here's how all three of these paragraphs are working together. You can have, remember the first guy, you can have everything. Yet, without giving to or pursuing relationship with other people, you have hevel. Okay? So remember this guy, two hands full. He's got it all. But because he has no second, because he has no other, it's empty. It's frustrating. It's an unhappy business. And you're going to have this middle section. Here's the benefits of companionship. three examples, right? You get safety and you get encouragement and you get warmth and you get help and comfort and all these great things. And then another example, you can have everything. You could be the greatest king to rule the greatest kingdom. Yet without others, without receiving from hearing other people, there's hevel. So the first is the sin of not giving or not having. Second one is the sin of not receiving people in both directions. And without both of those, you don't have the benefit of companionship. Instead, you have hevel. So the last few minutes, might even be done early today. Consider this from the church perspective. There's one spot in my notes that I had skipped that I'm hoping to use as a conclusion here. So think about this from the perspective of one another, okay? The benefits that are found in the middle are not necessarily hyper-spiritual benefits, are they? He's just talking about the joy of having other people around you. And I think that we can learn from that. He's not talking about, okay, so go get involved in your local church. Of course, that's not what he's saying. I think it's a proper application to say the people that you have around you, if you're willing to not just be a Sunday morning church person, but that you are willing to open yourself up to being known and to knowing other people, the giving and receiving elements of community, there is tremendous blessing in that, practically and spiritually. Spiritually is practical, but you know what I'm saying? Like it's really great to know Aaron when your motorcycle breaks down. Been there, right? Like sitting on the side of the road, been there. It's great to have a companion, right? But there's also incredible benefit spiritually. Think about it, the idea of fighting, right? Which he says that it's better to not be caught in a dark alley by yourself, right? Think about that spiritually. Think about that in your own heart. Think about that from the standpoint of temptation. It's worse to try and go at this Christian life by yourself. That's not how God intended us to do it. God intended us to need each other and to benefit from each other. When you're struggling with the depths of sin or doubt, what's the best thing to do? To talk about it. Maybe not with everybody. That's okay. You don't have to get up and share a testimony of the dark, horrible thing that's going on. But you need one. You need to not be the one who is one person with no second, because you lose the benefit of the body of Christ. So many people today want the relationship with Jesus without the relationship with other believers. And you miss out on the creative intent, yes, of each other as humanity, but yes, also the intent of the church. So any thoughts or questions, comments, complaints, before we close in prayer?